Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to write a story that readers cannot get out of their heads or their hearts? And how is the process different when that story will be told on screen instead of in print? Although his passion for collecting and dealing books is at least as strong as his interest in writing, it is that writing that has secured Texas native Larry McMurtry's fame. His best-known solo works include Terms of Endearment, The Last Picture Show, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lonesome Dove. Diana Ossana worked in law before turning her focus to writing short stories and essays full-time. Since 1992, they have often written together, collaborating on multiple television miniseries, the novels Pretty Boy Floyd and Zeke and Ned, and the Academy Award-winning screen adaptation of the short story Brokeback Mountain by Annie Proulx. They're in town for a sold-out Nasher Salon Series event this evening, and we're happy to have them as our guests. Diana, Larry, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What's the difference between being together on a project and writing something entirely solo?
Well, let me give you a little history. I had heart surgery at the end of 1991, and I had been a prolific screenwriter, not a very good one, but a prolific one prior to that. After the trauma that sometimes accompanies heart surgery, I could not write screenplays. You have to be able to think more or less sequentially in order to write screenplays, and I couldn't. So I was recuperating at Diana's house in Tucson, and the Pretty Boy Floyd project came along, and she was interested in it, and I talked her into writing with me. Otherwise, I would have written no screenplays. I could still write fiction, but I couldn't write. Couldn't focus in the way you need to focus. Screenplays are for me much harder than novels. Novels just flow out, and screenplays don't. So I talked her into being my partner.
Well, the other part of that, though, too, is that when you write with someone, it's fairly common to collaborate in writing screenplays, not so common in novels, although it happens quite a bit. But you get instant feedback on your writing. That's one of the good things about doing it with screenplays. I'm writing a screenplay by myself right now, and it's been more difficult in the sense that I just have to do it, and I'm not getting any feedback from anybody other than my own self-criticism. So I'll finish a draft and I'll have Larry read it, and then I'll get notes from him, you know, on what he thinks. But no, that's the biggest difference, I think, is that you get instant feedback when you do it with a collaborator.
Having worked together for now 16 years, do you find, though, that you have his voice in your head anyway, that you sort of know if he were sitting right next to you or if he were working on the same project, what he might say?
No, not always, because he's pretty unpredictable with his criticism. I mean, because Larry's he's a mixed bag. You know, I can think I might know what he's going to say, and he could say something completely different.
Well, normally, since I work early, and I work a fixed number of pages a day, might be 5, might be 10, it would never be more than 10. On a script, it would probably be 5. And I'm through by 8:15 or 8:30, and I hand them to Diana, or I fax them if we're in different parts of the world. And then she has them for the day to expand or subtract or rearrange or whatever.
When we write together, we write, you know, that he writes in the morning and he writes a fixed number of pages. We're very different in that way. Yeah. I'll get them early. And he writes on a manual typewriter. That's the other difference. And then I write on a computer. So I'll take his stuff and I'll put it into my computer. Sometimes I'll put all of it in. Sometimes I won't. And then I'll just move forward. I'll expand and then move forward. You know, it just depends. And then I'm done. I might work a couple hours or I might work the rest of the day. And then Larry starts up again in the morning. And we do that every single day until we have a first draft. Every single day. We don't take any time off.
I never take a day off. It's so much harder. Writing prose or to some extent writing scripts is a matter of momentum. You have a certain momentum, and if you start having gaps or days when you don't work, you quickly lose that momentum. And the momentum is more important than having things perfect on the first draft, because you can always correct it once you get it trapped.
Is it more important that you agree on sort of the small details or the big things? When you come to a place where you disagree on the way something should proceed, what are the hang-ups most likely to be?
I think the big things are the most important, and we talk about those mostly before we begin. There'll be little things, and early on, say, for example, on the script for Pretty Boy, I would ask Larry questions a lot, but I realized very soon that it would be better just to do it and then let him look at it later, because he's very contrary. He disagrees with just about everything that anybody says, not just me. So if I
I'm a certified contrarian.
He is.
And I'm
definitely
old enough to be a contrarian.
You at least agreed with that.
I did.
He does agree with that.
I don't scrutinize things very much in the writing process. I tend to do the pages, and they pile up, and they pile up, and eventually the story is told.
And when he writes with me, he writes in a much more skeletal fashion. It just sort of expects
Diana
me to do what I need to do.
It.
So.
Larry, you mentioned that writing scripts is more challenging for you. And it's interesting to me because in a novel, you have control over what your characters say and do. Whereas when you're writing a script, you have to have extraordinary faith that the director will get it, that the actors will get it, because there's so much. I mean, a good script, and clearly your best scripts, are not all dialogue. Look at Brokeback Mountain. How do either one of you sort of get to a place where you trust that the people who you hand the script over to will do it properly?
Never. We never get to that point. I mean, it took 8 or 9 years for Brokeback to happen. It took nearly 9 years for Terms of Endearment to happen. Various people were cast and didn't get made, and other people were cast. But we never take for granted, it would be very foolish to take for granted, that it's going to be received in Hollywood the way you wrote it.
Well, and then to the rest of the world the way
to
you
the
wrote
rest
it either.
Of the world.
Because, you know, writing scripts naturally is collaborative. There's so many people that contribute to it. You're not just the creative people in terms of, you know, your director and your cast, but also the crew, the way they put things together, the costuming, everything. I mean, there's so many people involved, and the editing afterwards, all of those things. It's really a gamble. It's the biggest gamble of all, because you just never know. And as wonderful a script as Brokeback was considered during the years it languished in Hollywood, people would say it was the best thing they'd ever read, and then, you know, but they wouldn't commit. You just never know what's going to happen when somebody gets a hold of it and they get the actors and as it moves along. I mean, I was on the set the whole time watching the process happen, and I knew that the actors were doing amazing things, but you never know what's going to happen once it starts being put together.
And you know, the agents were not really pushing their actors to do this story because it was about homosexual cowboys. And so, we found actors who were willing to some extent, go past their agent or their agency.
Are there sort of tricks that you've learned, things to put in a script that you know will help sort of illuminate those moments? I mean, I don't know how much, I guess you write a treatment first, but with a short story, maybe you don't.
Well, we didn't do a treatment we rarely do a treatment, but with Brokeback, you had the short story. And in writing the script, when we write scripts together, Larry works pretty heartily. We're pretty equal on the first draft, but after that, he sort of checks out, and you know, I'll work on it, and he reads it, of course. But one of the things that I remember, the detail part of it, is the narrative. When you're describing the scene, I felt very strongly that the actors would need sort of a map when they were reading the script of what the character was thinking and feeling in a specific scene. For example, there's a scene in Brokeback where after Jack and Ennis have had their interlude in the tent, the next morning Ennis rides off and he's riding the ridge, and then he comes upon the sheep that's been gutted by a coyote. In the script I put, Ennis rides along the ridge, something eating at his mind. I mean, you see, you know, that's the description. And of course, when you see Heath up on the ridge riding the horse, you see that something's troubling him. So those are the kind of things you put in a script. I mean, it's very specific to whatever the story is that you're telling. It's not any, there are no real tricks. I mean, and the other part of that is you have to watch a lot of movies, so you know how movies appear once they're finished. And those are that's the kind of thing you think about when you're writing a script.
And you try to. I mean, we've been successful, and I was a little bit successful before I started working with Diana. because I have characters that appeal to major actors, and that's the most crucial. I mean, you have to have the star to get the money. And if you don't have, I mean, HUD, my first little movie made from Harsh and Passby, was made almost before the book was out because Paul Newman wanted the role so bad, and he brought the money. But Terms of Endearment, nobody brought the money for 8 or 9 years, and finally some of the money had to come from James Brooks himself, the director.
Writers Diana Ossana and Larry McMurtry are my guests. Larry, you've tended to go back to particular characters across from one novel to the next. And I'm wondering if in between those times, sometimes it's decades, if those characters sort of live on in real time in your imagination.
Well, I forget them for long stretches of times, but I have written four tetralogies, four books, four stories of which there are four books. And that's just because it's pleasant to revisit characters at different stages of their life. First they're young, then they're middle-aged, then they're old, or they're not quite old, and then they're really old. And that's something I don't know why I'm geared that way, but I am. I've written four tetralogies, which comes to 16 novels that in which there are connections. The novel has done that before. It's not, I mean, Faulkner did it, and various others have done it.
You've been working together since 1992. Had you known each other for a long time before then?
Not quite a decade. I think close to a decade. I think I met
about 7 years, I think.
7 or 8 years.
I'm curious about whether either one of you went and made a sort of a study of the other's work as you were getting to know each other as friends.
No,
I don't think so.
No, I mean, I had read the first novel of Larry's that I had read was in the early 70s, All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers. And I remember I really liked it a lot. I just thought it was so funny and enjoyable.
72.
And I'd seen the film Terms of Endearment. And then after I saw the movie, I read the book. And I had read Lonesome Dove. Actually, I think I had just finished reading Lonesome Dove right before I met Larry. And we just, our meeting was just serendipitous. So, you know.
And I'm wondering about the fact that neither one of you lives in Hollywood, and yet you obviously have to be back and forth for particular projects. Have you gotten to a place where you feel comfortable with the culture there, even if you choose not to be part of it?
I've always loved Los Angeles. I have no problems with it, except that the bookstores have died. I made a speech. I got an award from the L.A. Public Library about a month ago in which it became a lament, because although I started going there as a screenwriter in the early 60s, and I've been there hundreds of times, I went as much because the screenwriting job allowed me to do a lot of book scouting, and that's not happening anymore. They're gone. But we have lived in Los Angeles, and that's during periods of post-production on the two miniseries, Dead Man's Walk and Streets of Laredo, because you have to go to the mix studio every day. You can't commute to a post-production situation if you want to continue to be part of the shaping of the movie. So we lived there about a year and a half.
But, I mean, the culture you're talking about is more the work culture, right? The Hollywood culture, the executives and the studios and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
I guess it's like any work culture, whether it's doctors or lawyers. You know, you spend a lot of time with those people. And I don't know. I mean, it seems to be easier creatively to not be so much a part of that because, it, in a way, it kind of destroys your imagination and the kind of... I guess the fantasy of movies, you know. I still love movies. I love going to the movies. I like to see as many as I possibly can. But I find it to be an advantage to not be right in the thick of all that.
Diana Ossana and Larry McMurtry are my guests. We'll be back after a break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
Well, my old man, he's a bull rider. pretty well known in his day. Though he kept his secrets to himself and never taught me a thing, never once come to see me ride. Your brother and sister do right by you?
They did the best they could after my folks was gone. Considering they didn't leave us nothing but $24 in a coffee can. I got me a year of high school before the transmission went on the pickup. And then my sis left, met a roughneck, moved to Casper. And me and my brother, we went and got ourselves some work on a ranch up near Warland.
Till I was 19.
And then he got married, and no more room for me. And that's how come me end up here.
That's more words than you spoke in the past 2 weeks.
Hell, that's the most I've spoken in a year.
That was actors Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal in a scene from Brokeback Mountain. The Academy Award-winning screenplay was written by my guests, Larry McMurtry and Diana Osana. They're in town for a sold-out event tonight at the Nasher Salon. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Does working in film and in television and writing scripts affect the way you sort of see things and hear things in your mind when you're writing?
Not me.
Not really.
It's the exact same visualization for everything.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. The only time it affects anything, I think, is after we're finished with a draft, the first draft, and you begin to go back and look in terms of production costs and that kind of thing. You know, you might think, well, I don't know how they're going to possibly film this scene. It's going to cost too much money. But then, you know, if it fits the story, you leave it and figure, you know what, we'll worry about that later.
Make it someone else's problem.
That's right.
Exactly right. Sold. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great privilege to talk to you. Really enjoy y'all's, or Mr. McMurtry's art. So my question is, if you could give me some background on the development of the story Texasville, which is my favorite of his works. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Just met an actor who was in Texasville this morning when we went on Good Morning Texas or whatever, that he played Dwayne's son in the movie Texasville. I had no connection with Texasville. I wrote the book in the period after my heart surgery when I spewed out books pretty much at random. I could write fiction as fast as I could type, but I couldn't do anything else much. And I didn't work on this movie, Texasville, at all and had really no connection with it.
A lot of people, Larry, are surprised. Now people really know about your other passion, which is collecting books and dealing books, but people are somehow, they seem disappointed by the idea that this is something that appeals to you at least as much as writing. They assume that that should be the only thing you want to do.
Well, that's a romantic view of both writing and bookselling.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very romantic view. You know, I wrote very passionately for 20 some odd years, but I've been writing for more than 50 years. It's not, I don't think, anything against writing at all, that you have a vocation and you have a passion. And at some point in the 70s, I think writing ceased to be my passion, and rare books had always been my passion to some extent.
What I know that you were the one who found Annie Proulx's story initially and sent it to Larry, Diana. How often do you read something and share it with each other for purposes of potentially working on it as a project?
Not much, and I didn't send it to Larry. I was staying at his house in Texas and took it downstairs the morning after I read it and asked him to read it. And I said, there's a story. I handed him the New Yorker, and I said, there's a story in here I want you to read. And he said, what is it? And I said, it's a short story. He said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, I don't read short fiction because I can't write it. And I said, will you just read this one and humor me, please? And he agreed to, and he went upstairs, read it, came back down, and I could tell he was moved, because usually if he doesn't like something, he'll say right off the bat, you know, that was, I didn't like that, or that was a waste of time, or whatever. He didn't say anything, and I said, what'd you think? He says, well, it's one of the better short stories I've read in the New Yorker. And then I said, you know, do you think we could write a script from this? And as I've said this before, and I'll say it again, it's the first, probably the last time in 22 years he agreed with me about something right off the bat. He said, sure. So we wrote Annie a letter that day and asked her if she would consider optioning the story to us to write a script. And we heard back in about a week, and she said, you know, I don't see a movie here, but have at it. Now, we share things, not so much for work purposes, but more for enjoyment. You know, I'll say, I read this article, or I read this book, or he'll say, this is good, something you should look at, kind of thing, but not essentially for work, really.
Well, Diana has a job at the moment. I don't have a job at the moment. We don't have a job at the moment. So I read books almost every day, casting about to see if I can find something that we could credibly get a deal on.
Is there a difference, Larry, in reading when you're casting about for something you might get a deal on as opposed to just reading for pure pleasure?
Yes, there is. You're reading to see if you have characters, the story has characters in it that would attract a major actor or actress, and you're reading professionally.
And it's not for me, though. I'm exactly the opposite. When I read Brokeback, I was reading for pleasure. That's it. And it grabbed me. It literally grabbed me by the throat and shook me. And I felt very quickly that this was something that would make a powerful film. But it wasn't. I didn't read it with the intention of reading something to adapt.
And we're always looking for jobs, you know. Right now, everything is stalled. Nobody knows if the actors are going to strike or not. We would like to have something on the scoreboard professionally, and I do a lot of reading with that intent.
Your personal library is 28,000 volumes, is what's always written, is that right?
That's about right.
There's got to be a huge amount of pressure to owning that many books, knowing that you'll never get through every single one of them.
Well, I have got through most of them.
Have you really? Wow.
At least
I've held them in my hand and considered them, and I tried to decide whether this is a book I want to read, reread, whatever. And I have a little book plate which corresponds to my family's brand. And if I decide the book is something I might want to reread, I'll put the book plate in it. Otherwise, I'll probably take it to the bookstore and sell it.
Now, there's no reason to have a book in your library you haven't read.
No. I have given some thought to all of them.
Is there something that you like about them about owning them beyond just the content? Is there something about
this? But they're fertilizers. I said this in my LA speech. It's like an aquifer. They trickle down into the writing. They always have. And I've bought books in more than 1,000 bookshops all over the world. And yet I feel that they're there as a resource. And for me and for James and for Curtis. And who knows how far it will go. But I feel that the connection between my library and my writing is very close.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Barbara in Grapevine. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Well, I would like to tell Mr. McMurtry that absolutely probably the favorite novel I've ever read was Lonesome Dove. I thought it was beautifully written. If I were an English teacher, that would be required reading. I'm curious as to when he felt that at first, you know, knew he could write, like, you know, how old was he and what kind of things was he doing? And also, who are some of his favorite current writers?
I sort of knew I could write when my third book was published, The Last Picture Show. Up to then, it had been tentative, although I had published two books, but I wasn't sure this was going to carry through my life. And after the third one, I sort of knew that it was. I read away from where I work. You know, I've reviewed a lot of novels, nearly 1,000, but not in the last 25 years. And I just don't read fiction anymore unless I'm looking for a screen project.
Why don't you read fiction anymore?
Burned out. Mm-hmm. Reviewed too many books, too many novels. I would always, as a reviewer, review novels, sometimes four or five in a single review. And then, you know, I got up to 900 or something like that, and I just stopped wanting to read fiction. Also, you don't want to go for pleasure where you have to be for work. And when I don't see movies either. Diana sees all the movies. I don't see any movies because it's my work. I mean, it's a professional duty just me to see a movie. I did once really love movies and saw them for pleasure. Not anymore.
Is it hard for you, Diana, to understand that? Even though you're together all the time and working on things together. Is it hard for you to hear that and imagine yourself in the same state?
It's not hard for me to hear it at all. Larry and I are very different in a lot of ways, but I think that's why we complement one another. It's funny, too. We've described ourselves like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, but we reverse roles occasionally, you know, when we'll be the practical person and when we'll be the dreamer. But no, it doesn't bother me at all. It's easy for me to sit down and watch film for pleasure, and I also still love reading fiction. And Larry will read fiction when it's about a job. If we say, "Oh, this is a book we need to look at to see if it's something we, you know, that we could adapt or might interest us or interest studios or actors." But no, that's not difficult for me to hear.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guests are writers Diana Ossana and Larry McMurtry. They are at a Nasher Salon Series event tonight that has been sold out. There is, however, a waiting list. If you'd like to send email, the email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Carrie in the Hill Country. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say thank you for filling so many hours of my life with such great literature. And I look forward to consuming more of it. And I've spent hours also in your store. It's easy to walk in, really hard to get out for someone like me.
Good.
I grew up, spent many summers in Dundee and in Archer City growing up. My grandmother had the post office there in Dundee over 40 years. So I have many, many fond memories of that area. And I wanted to ask you a quick question. There was reference in the book, The Wandering Hill, to a place that maybe near where I used to live out in West Texas, near the confluence of the Salt Fork and the Double Mountain Fork of the Brazos River, a little mountain called Kiowa Peak. And it fit the description perfectly.
The Berry Benders, when they were seeing the Wandering Hill, were way north of there. They were up on the Yellowstone. And they saw it in two or three places, but I don't believe they got as far south as the Double Mountain Fork of the Brazos. But that's just, I'm just imagining it. But they were making their turn from the junction of the Yellowstone and the Missouri when they saw the Wandering Hill.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Next on the line, we have Richard calling from Ponder. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. It's sure good to hear Larry. I got a couple. First of all, I'm 74 years old, and Last Picture Show is one of my favorites simply because in Archer City when I was a kid, I ate in the cafe, I sat in the movie, and I played pool in the pool hall, and they were functioning in those days. They're not functioning now, and I've got recent pictures. But then I got another question. How do you come up with the name Lonesome Dove, and where do you find it?
I found it just south of Ponder when I was coming back from eating a steak at the Ranchman's when I lived in Fort Worth, and an old church bus was sitting beside the road which said Lonesome Dove Baptist Church. There is all that's left of Lonesome Dove. It was never a community. It was always just a cemetery and a church, and it's kind of just north and slightly west of the runway at DFW.
I guess people must often approach work that either one of you have done and feel a direct connection to the place. And are they always a combination of your imagination and what actually exists or existed?
Sure.
I think so. It has to be.
Yeah, sure.
Are there times when, I mean, I would imagine that you'd sort of want to experience them for yourself, or do you feel like the experience, having written about them, is as profound a connection as you can have to a place, whether real or imagined?
I think so. I mean, sometimes visiting a place ruins it imaginatively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think it's better to have it in your imagination. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, I think so. Although I have traveled the West pretty comprehensively, and I have a fairly, I mean, I heard, I talked to James, my musician son, yesterday, and he's going to a festival in Ten Sleep, Wyoming, which I wrote about and actually visited many years ago, but I still have an image of Ten Sleep.
1-800-933-5372 is our phone number. Let's go next to Susan in Royce City. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Chris. I have enjoyed listening to your program so much, and
thank
I'm
you.
Very much enjoying this today with Chris and Diane, is it?
Diana and Larry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Right. Well, our family has Lonesome Dove is our family favorite for any trip. We put an old videotape or two, however many it takes to run it. And we went through West Texas up through New Mexico and Colorado one year, and it was just the landscape just evoked everything in the book. It was such a pleasure. And we stayed at the Turkey Hotel, which was a turn-of-the-century hotel. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was extraordinary, and I would recommend it to anyone if it's still operating. But my question for you is, I have a very just driven need to find old books, and I buy them, you know, very, very cheaply. I don't have a lot of money to spend on them, and I don't know anything about collecting them. Is there a good resource that you can recommend?
We will get an answer for you, Susan, after the break. We are speaking with Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You know, it could be like this, just like this, always.
Yeah, how do you figure that?
What if you and me had a little ranch somewhere, a little cow and calf operation? It'd be a sweet life. I mean, hell, Lorraine's old man, you better give me a down payment to get lost. I mean, he more or less already said it.
No, I told you it ain't gonna be that way. You know, you got your wife and baby in Texas, and, you know, I got my life in Riverton.
That's so. You and Alma, that's a lie.
Oh, you shut up about Alma. This ain't her fault. The bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again in the wrong place, in the wrong time. We're dead.
Another clip from Brokeback Mountain, which was written as a screenplay by Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana, who are my guests. They're in town for a Nasher Salon Series event tonight. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Susan had called to ask for some ideas about getting started as a book collector.
Well, come to the bookshop in Archer City, and there's unfortunately no one comprehensive book that will do it. But the book I just published called Books, A Memoir, is a start, and it will lead you to other books.
And that's the story of your life as a collector.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a bookman. Mm-hmm. I'm not really a collector. You know, I have 28,000 books, but I'm what we call in the trade an accumulator. That is, my 28,000 books haven't been formed as a collection about any one subject. They've just been what I read to inform myself.
What you wanted to read.
Right.
Is there some sort of Holy Grail volume that you really want?
That question's come up two or three times. No, there's a bunch. There's a lot, but there's not. I can't really. It's like asking, what's your favorite novel or something like that. Too many to count.
Mm-hmm. Are you also a collector or I guess you're not a dealer, Diana,
no.
but how do you view your relationship to the books that you own and want to own?
I love them. I love books. I've loved them since I first started reading, down to having those little golden books when you were 4 or 5 years old. I have my own library at home, which I don't know how many books are
7 or 8,000.
Yeah, that's all I could fit in the house. And I built shelves in my bathroom and in the hallways and in the foyer. And I shipped off 20 boxes of books to Larry's ranch house where they live now because I had so many books they just had to sit in boxes. But no, I love books and I love reading. And that's probably one of the reasons that Larry and I initially developed our friendship after we met. We both had such a serious love of books and of reading. And I mean, the physical, actually having the physical book in your hands is such to me, a wonderful experience. I love turning the pages and looking at the cover and, you know, just touching it, holding it, reading it.
They almost represent something before you ever open them. You just don't quite know what you're going to get when you dive in.
Exactly.
We have an email from Dan in Plano who asks, with the advent of the internet and blogging, do you think that reading is a dying art?
I think it's challenged. I certainly do. But I notice that young kids still love to read, love to be read to, love to have books. And when they get to be about 10 or 11 or 12, they are hit with a tsunami of technology. iPads and iPhones and laptops and da-da-da-da-da. And I think at that point there's serious resistance to reading. I think the technology is that kind of sweeps them past it sometimes. I don't know. I think it's threatened.
Yeah, it's funny. We talk so much about things being interactive, and nothing could be more interactive in some ways than reading a book and having to lend your own imagination to what you're reading, but it's not viewed as sort of a high-tech way to move about the world.
No, but it's still a way to experience life. I mean, I think I learned a tremendous amount about life and about people by reading fiction as a child. It was a tremendous escape for me, and it still is. And I think that young people are doing themselves a disservice by moving away from it. Certainly the computer and the internet and all of that, it interests me as well. I can spend hours reading, but when I sit down to read a book that engages me with characters that I can either relate to or become, whether they're male or female, it's a wonderful thing to go into that world and to learn about things that you know absolutely nothing about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Philip in Dallas. Hi, Philip.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. McMurtry. As you were writing Lonesome Dove, did you write it with the specific actors in mind that played the parts in there? And if so, it was magnificent casting. I thought the movie and the book paralleled each other. It was like having your dream come to life. And thank you so very much, and I'll take the answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Actually, the true origins of Lonesome Dove is a screenplay written about 20 years earlier with Peter Bogdanovich, or for Peter Bogdanovich, and the three characters were John Wayne, James Stewart, and Henry Fonda. That failed to find a sponsor. It sort of languished in limbo for 15, 20 years. And then I wrote the book, and I had to buy the book back because I didn't own it. I had written the screenplay as a work for hire from Warner Brothers. I bought it back. I wrote the novel. It failed to find anyone who could make it as a feature. It just was too expensive. And it went to television, and this was at a time when neither Westerns nor miniseries were much wanted, and yet it got made. And the casting was last minute, as it almost always is in television. Robert Duvall had been cast in the Call role, not the Gus role. Switched over. They had wanted to cast James Garner, but he had a heart condition. He couldn't ride a horse. And many changes. Most of television, most miniseries are last minute. whoever's on hiatus from whatever show they're in that might be on, that might belong to the network that's making the miniseries. So it was a combination of a lot of things.
Do you have a preference for whether your work is made into something for television or for film?
Not really. I think it just depends on, I mean, the venue. With a miniseries, of course, you can travel a lot of territory that you can't with a feature. It just depends on the material.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bill in Azle. Hi, Bill.
Hello. A question for Mr. McMurtry. Mr. McMurtry, the Royal Theater.
Yeah.
The old theater in Azle in the 40s and 50s is called the Royal. And I know you mentioned Azle in some of your writing, like Home for Christmas and such. Was that any kind of inspiration for you or just a...
No, because the Archer City Theater was also called the Royal, and that's the one I went to. I only drove through Azle a few times in my childhood when we were going to the, when Fort Worth still had the stockyards. So it was the Royal Theater, which has now been turned, restored and turned into a stage theater in Archer City.
I would imagine, Larry, that you get sort of pitched by people from little towns all over the West that want you to visit their place and be inspired by whatever is to be found there.
No, not so much. I do get, many people who have stories they want me to tell. Mm-hmm. And I can't.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Catherine in Irving. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I was actually calling to say that the novel Dwayne's Depressed is one of my absolute favorites. And I was wondering if Mr. McMurtry had any thoughts of writing his own screenplay for it.
Well, we have had the thought of writing a spec script for Dwayne's Depressed, because I don't think anybody will ever pay us to do it. We'll have to do it on our own and then
we'll write our own script probably and then get it made.
And then try to get it made.
But it's a lot of people's favorite book.
A lot of people, including mine.
I love that book too.
So, yeah, you can have a favorite book. You wouldn't have a favorite book that you want to own, but you don't mind having favorites among your own works. That's interesting.
Well, I think it's natural. I've written over 40 books, and most of them I've forgotten. There are three or four that I still like to think about, like The Desert Rose and Loop Group and Dwayne's Depressed.
Are there any that come up over and over that you think, God, I wish I'd never read that or never written it?
I just forget those books. I don't have a very good memory. And I tend to be forward-going rather than backward-looking. So
yeah, Larry's like a shark when it comes to his work. He just moves forward.
I move forward. I don't go...
It's miles in the past.
Yeah, it's miles in the past. I don't think about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Larry, I am, too, a customer of Archer City Bookstore.
Good.
I appreciate everything you have there. My question is, I read in the USA Today that you guys were casting about for another idea, maybe along the lines of Native American Indians. And I read a phenomenal book, and I was in the Black Hills actually last week about Black Elk Speaks. And I was wondering if you've read that book and if there's any inspiration there and anything out of Wallace Stegner's, and I'll listen.
Black Elk Speaks, of course, I've read. I have written about Black Elk in my book about Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley, because Black Elk went to London with the Buffalo Bill's troop the first time they went, and he got lost, and he wandered over to Paris, and Buffalo Bill picked him up the second time he came through Paris and sent him home because he recognizes he was very homesick. So I know about Black Elk. I don't think there's a movie there. I'm not sure, but it's not. Black Elk, the Black Elk Speaks itself is controversial because it was recorded by the two daughters of, I've forgotten his name, the poet who wrote the ballad of Hugh Glass. Anyway, and people, Native Americans, some of them question whether the translation of Black Elk Speaks is accurate or inaccurate or fraudulent or whatever.
With both of you writing every single day, are there ever sort of things that get shuttled aside or wasted or just that you both acknowledge were an exercise for the day? Or does everything find its way to something that is intended to be published or produced?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have many scraps myself. I pretty much use up what there is to be used.
Larry's just written a book, though, that he claims will never be published. He just finished it the other day.
I needed closure with fiction. I've run out of gas as a fiction writer. I know it. I'm aware of it. And I don't need to publish any more fiction. 30 novels is enough. But I had to write this book in order to get fiction out of since I've written it every day for 50 years or more, it's a habit. But it's not a good habit anymore. It's a bad habit now. So I wrote on to the end of Duane Moore's life, and I just put it in a box, and it'll stay in that box.
Do you like writing?
Hmm?
Do you like writing?
I like writing very much. Not fiction, though. I don't want to write any more fiction. I can still do Belle Lettre. I could do a biography. I've been thinking about a biography of Mackenzie, the man who, the young army officer who essentially broke the Comanches. Went mad in the week that he was supposed to be married and stayed mad insane the rest of his life. I could write a biography. I can write essays. I can write reviews. But I've written enough fiction.
You've read the sequel to Duane's Depressed. Did you like it?
Oh, the one that he's just finished?
Right, the one that will never be published?
No, I have only read pieces of it.
But there is one that is published called When the Light Goes. That's the sequel to Duane's Depressed.
But the post sequel, the part three.
No, I haven't read the whole thing at all because I've been busy writing. But I've watched Larry write for 20 years. You know, and he has said this several times before that he's done with fiction. So who knows if it's true or not? He can argue about it till the cows come home. But who knows? And yet I've watched him. He'll stop and start writing. Larry, it's been what I've observed with his writing is that with fiction, it's almost for him like eating or sleeping, writing fiction. He just does it. He's done it. And he's been a much easier person to be around when he's writing than when he isn't. He's much more tolerable.
Well, it's not rational, writing fiction. It's more like something you do in a trance-like state, and I found it very easy to do after the heart surgery. I mean, they came so quick; it was like getting a fax from the other part of myself that I left behind after that surgery.
Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana will appear this evening at a Nasher Salon Series event. Tickets are sold out, although there is a waiting list. It's been great to have both of you this hour. Thank you so
much.
Thank you,
Chris. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.